Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. The Yes Brain, how to cultivate courage, curiosity, and resilience in your child, by Daniel J. Siegel, MD, and Tina Payne Bryson, PhD. It gives parents and children the tools and courage necessary to face the challenges of our rapidly changing world. It guides us in the cultivation of a receptive, curious brain in our children. It's a blueprint for raising confident, creative children in a fear-based world. When kids are guided by a yes brain, they're more curious and imaginative and less worried about making mistakes. They're more open and creative and resilient. And the authors give parents skills to bring kids of all ages into the yes state. Daniel Siegel, MD, is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine. He's the founding co-director of UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center and executive director of Midnight Institute. Tina Bryson, who joins us today, Dr. Bryson, is the founder and executive director of the Center for Connection, an interdisciplinary team in Pasadena, California. She's a licensed clinical social worker providing pediatric and adolescent psychotherapy and parenting consultations. She joins me via phone, and I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Dr. Bryson, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I can't wait to talk about these ideas with you.
Oh, yeah. I've been looking forward to it. Why did you write The Yes Brain, How to Cultivate Courage and Curiosity and Resilience? I mean, what was your impetus?
Well, you know, Dan and I have this wonderful partnership, and we've written two books together previous to this, The Whole Brain Child and No Drama Discipline. And we were sitting together and saying, do we want to write another book? Is there, you know, what is it that's really on our hearts right now? What is it we're seeing? And Dan and I are both parents. His children are in their young adulthood, and I have two teenagers. I have a 17-year-old, a 14-year-old, and an 11-year-old. And we're both clinicians who have worked with a lot of kids, adolescents, and parents. And one of the things that we were sort of seeing in the world and in our families and in the clients that we work with was really that parents struggle with some version of the same question, and educators are too. And the question really comes down to, what is it that my child or teenager needs to really be successful in the world? And, you know, I think these questions are coming from a lot of concerns, a lot of fear that we have. As we know, adolescents are more depressed and anxious than ever in our history. And so Dan and I really started playing with this idea, what is it that kids really need to have in order to really be successful in the world? And so as we brainstormed, we came up with four basic fundamentals of what that looks like. And we noticed that it actually all kind of emanates from the same part of the brain. And we talked about how that's sort of a brain that's like a yes brain that can say yes to the world and can handle adversity and difficulty in a really strong way.
Well, as you look at what parents really need to do, how would you describe overall maybe the mistakes or missteps that parents make in raising their children today?
Oh, my. That could be three shifts.
I know. But
and I say this not from a place of judgment either. This is something that I wrestle with, too, as a parent. You know, we have so many options and choices, and so it's really hard to know how to invest our time. But I will say that I think, and this is going to require a huge mind shift.
Okay.
I think the biggest mistake that parents make, and I, like I said, I can include myself in that as well, is that when our children are in states of distress, when they're really struggling or when their behavior is really problematic or concerning, we often respond in ways that amplify our children's distress mm-hmm. and make it less mm-hmm. likely that they can learn and build skills and build resilience. And so I think we add fuel and fire to the pot. And part of that is sort of a second point, but related. I think the other big mistake that we make in this culture in terms of parents and even educators is that we focus just on the surface level behavior or just on what the child is saying or doing, and we're completely missing what's happening in the internal landscape of the child. And if we focus there instead, it's going to create a lot less reactivity, a better relationship. Kids will be more flexible and develop resilience and skills. So I guess to sum it up, one would be to have a yes-brain parenting kind of response where we decrease the reactivity in ourselves and our kids. And the second would be to focus on what's really happening inside the child or the teenager instead of just focusing on the behavior.
Okay. All right. And I think you've really answered this next question that I was thinking about, but I think it'll be helpful for the listening audience is, in turn, how do we avoid these pitfalls? And I guess the way we avoid the pitfalls is what you're saying or what I'm hearing, and you correct me, is that you really have to have a change in your perspective. In the way you deal, because if everything that you're doing is reactive, then that's one of the pitfalls.
Yeah, and when we respond that way, mm-hmm. our children learn to respond that way, and that's how their brains get wired. So here's a really fundamental piece that I think a lot of people know, but it's worth remembering, and that is that the way we respond to our children, the kinds of experiences and communication and interactions we have with them are not just influencing their characters or their mm-hmm. minds or their feelings in the moment. They are truly building the architecture and the connections of their brain. So it's sort of wiring up who they become in the world. That's kind of part of their automatic way of responding in the world. So here's the thing that I think is so helpful, and we can get into this, you know, really deeply, but the main idea is that the brain is either in a reactive state, which we mm-hmm. call a no brain, mm-hmm. Or it's in a receptive state, which we call a yes brain. And in that no brain reactive state, the child is stuck in their emotions. They are guarded mm-hmm. or defensive, shut down, rigid, attacking, rejecting, fearful, anxious, fight, flight, freeze kind of stuff. But the receptive yes brain is connected and flexible and sees obstacles as challenges and willing to be curious and take on new things. It's kind of a whole approach to the world that's really resilient mm-hmm. and emotionally balanced. And so I think what we really need to do is recognize when we are in reactive no brain states and calm ourselves down before interacting with our family, and recognize that when our child is in that state, a reactive no-brain state, they can't learn in that state, right. They can't have a thoughtful, mm-hmm. respectful conversation with us when they're in that state. And so it's a huge mind shift because we can say, okay, my kid's having a no-brain reactive brain right now, mm-hmm. and so the first thing my job is to do is to either give them the space or the support, whatever works best for them, to help move them back into a receptive place. And that's where the really helpful skill-building conversations take place, not mm-hmm. in the reactive moments, either where we're reactive or our kids are.
Well, as we look at these challenges, what role does culture play in the challenges? I mean, does it influence at all? And when I say culture, I'm talking about race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. What role, if any, it may not play any, in perspective or dealing with the no brain, yes brain. But then again, it may. And I just wonder, have you looked at it from that perspective at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that. I'm as a trained social mm-hmm. worker, I think about that a lot. And I think one of the things that I think about when it comes to culture, and especially when you talk about socioeconomic status, is you know, we know that there are different types of stress. We know that positive stress, which is kind of like a mild little stress that motivates us to do something well or to get up and handle ourselves really well. Then there's tolerable stress. And tolerable stress is where something's really challenging. It's almost like we're walking up a slope, but it's kind of steep. And we can handle it, but we can't handle it for too terribly long. You know,
right.
It can be something that can, it's pretty stressful, but we can take it, we can tolerate it. And then there's toxic stress. And that's basically where the slope of the hill is so steep that it causes us to be in these toxic states. And so what we really need to do is to think about what are the kinds of challenges or stressors that families are facing because of those circumstances. And we need to think about how we as parents can help lessen that and provide kind of a safe haven. The one thing that I think cuts across everything, socioeconomic status, race, any kind of cultural issues, is more a very basic need that we all have for connection and for relationships. And so regardless of any kind of circumstances surrounding these things, that if we focus on relationship and connection and know that as mammals, what we need most is to be connected to each other, to show up for each other, and to help lessen toxic stress.
Okay. As a practicing therapist, what are some of the recurrent parenting issues that you may encounter on a regular basis?
Well, okay, here's where I want to address that question, but if you'll be patient with me, I want to sort of lay out a little picture of something
okay.
that's in the book that I think
yes.
is so helpful.
Yes.
Okay, so we have two branches to our nervous system. We have a sympathetic branch, which is like the gas pedal that revs us up and kind of gets turned, the dial on that gets turned way up if we're angry or fearful or frustrated or even really excited. So as emotions intensify, that sympathetic branch gets more activated. And then we have a parasympathetic branch, which is like the gas pedal that slows us down and brings us back into states of calm. And eventually, if it gets turned down far enough, we can go to sleep at night and all of these things. When those two branches of our whole nervous system and brain are well balanced, we're going to call that the green zone. And when we're in the green zone, that's definitely a yes brain state where we're balanced. And even if emotions run really high or we're in really challenging circumstances, we can stay in control of ourselves and be really resilient and balanced.
We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return very shortly and you can continue. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm talking via phone with Dr. Tina Bryson. She is the co-author of The Yes Brain, How to Cultivate Courage, Curiosity, and Resilience in Your Child. Dr. Bryson, I'd had to interrupt you. You were just talking about that green zone, but let's continue with that.
You got it.
Okay.
So when we're in the green zone, we're balanced. We can handle things really well. And this is really where, you know, when your kids are in the green zone, they're amazing. You know, when they're in the green zone, they have empathy for each other. They might even spontaneously apologize for something they've done that they know they shouldn't have done. They handle disappointments well. You know, it's such this wonderful place. And that's when they're most open to learning. Now, if we get too upset, if our nervous system kind of goes into alarm, we detect a threat in the environment, or our emotions run really high, we move into the red zone. And this is basically where our nervous system goes, you know, into really intense states. And when we move into the red zone, we actually have physical changes in our bodies. Our muscles tighten up. Our heart starts beating faster. We might get hot. We often, you know, grit our teeth. But this is often where really reactive, acting out behaviors, aggressive behaviors, disrespectful kinds of things happen. And that would be a reactive state, obviously, as opposed to that green receptive state. Another reactive state would be the opposite of that we're going to call the blue zone. And the blue zone is more shut down and collapsed and kind of internalizing and withdrawing. So what we know is that when we're in the green zone, our social engagement circuitry is on. and we can be connected internally and connected to other people and handle ourselves well. When we're in the red zone or the blue zone, our social engagement circuitry goes off. And we actually, Stephen Porges, who has this whole scientific-based theory called the polyvagal theory, talks about how really what happens is we have this thing that he calls neuroception that's sort of like this automatic perception of our nervous systems that say, danger, danger, danger. So when we feel safe, we're in the green. But when we feel like there's a threat happening, we go into red or blue. Now, there are some kids who have a really narrow green zone. It doesn't take much to throw them into one of these reactive, either shut down blue or overactive, acting out red zones. And there are lots of reasons for that. And we can talk about those. But what's so key is that we can understand that about ourselves as parents, that we should not be interacting with our kids unless we are in the green zone. And that if our kids are not in the green zone, they need some help getting back in. And we can talk about how to do that. But this is very simple to help kids understand, too. In fact, at my Center for Connection, we've taught this in groups with kids, emotional regulation groups, where we talk about the red volcano and the green meadow and the blue iceberg. Or, you know, you can use animals to describe them or whatever. But what happens clinically, what Dan and I see a lot in our practices are kids who kind of live in the red zone with intense anxiety and perfectionism and kind of, you know, really disrespectful relationships with their parents. Or we see kids who are more in the blue zone where they're depressed and pulling away from social connection. The reasons for those can be a wide number of things. It could be something organic like an anxiety or depressive disorder. It sometimes is an environmental mismatch where the demands of their life are so huge and they don't quite have the capacity to meet those demands. And so there's that gap there that causes them to be in these kind of more toxic, stressful scenarios.
Or,
history and all of these things can be part of that as well.
Excuse me, let me interrupt you. Or I was thinking when you find kids that are in that zone, or it may be that to function in their milieu, they have to be in that. Does that make sense? You know what I mean? They have to, even though it's the reactive, and we see that the reactive really is not the positive way, they have to be reactive to make it in their world. Does
that
make
sense? That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that's such a beautiful way to say it. I actually have not thought of it in that term, but what I would say that is if you're in an environment that is threatening, it's appropriate to be in the red zone or the blue zone. The goal is not to avoid this. We just don't want to be in them all the time.
Right.
And that's
right.
Where that toxic stress comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why, you know, a huge part of this book and this approach that Dan and I are teaching is really a call for us to reexamine what we mean when we say success. I mean, another impetus for the book, you asked that earlier, is that Dan and I were talking about how we've in our own circles and in our clinical circles, we have come across so many kids who have, by all definitions of typical success, have been tremendously successful. They've earned all the trophies and the gold stars, and they are these stellar students who are going to top colleges, and they have six other enrichment activities that are talents that have been developed. And there's nothing wrong with having those kinds of successes. There's nothing wrong with academic success and going to wonderful colleges. That is wonderful. But if it comes at the cost of developing an inner life or play or connection with people, then it's a problem. And Dan and I have just seen so many kids who, by all measures of success, are the best of the best. But they don't have an internal compass. They're lost. They've finished college at the best place with the best degrees and all these things, and then they don't know who they are. They don't know how to handle adversity in the world. And so I think if our kids are living in toxic stress, where they have to kind of stay in the red zone to survive, we've got to really question what that environment is really doing to them and at what cost.
And, you know, what also may have happened is that their parents may not have allowed them to even evolve to handle adversity because they may zoom in when adversity, you know, appears, and they take care of it. So the kids have not had any experience in dealing with adversity because someone else has always dealt with it for them.
You are so right, and that is such a huge current parenting trend. And I understand that impulse as a parent. I do when our babies are hurting. We want to make it stop. But the first thing we have to do is to tolerate ourselves the negative emotions that we feel.
Right.
But we have to allow our children to feel. So one of the ways that Dan and I talk about that in the book is about bubble wrapping kids. Because when we bubble wrap them and protect them or distract them from any discomfort or distress or challenge, not only do we make them more fragile, because the way we develop resilience and tolerating adversity and coming out successfully is by practicing dealing with difficult things. And so not only do they become more fragile and less resilient, but it also prevents them from fully developing empathy, because if they aren't allowed to feel and struggle, they're not going to identify that feeling in others.
Yeah, good point. And another thing I'm wondering is, do our educational systems, and I know I'm being very general there, but I don't want to say public education because I think you can find it in private education and parochial education, but how do they play into this? What role or how do they influence?
Well, you know, one of the things that's really exciting, being out, getting to work with so many schools, is to see that a lot of schools, and you're right, across the board, sometimes they're in all different sort of facets of education, that a lot of schools are sort of making significant shifts in how they see kids, how they respond to kids, and what they're doing. So it's really exciting to see so many schools making changes. But the majority of schools, I think, focus just on achievement. They focus on surface level behavior, and what they're missing is that they're missing relationship, they're missing reflection, they're missing sort of the problem solving skills that are outside, you know, and the creativity that comes from struggling with things. Because what happens is parents and educators, you know, everything gets ratcheted higher and higher and higher, and we say you have to have straight A's and you have to do perfect and all of these things. And when that message gets communicated, kids, it is not safe for kids to be creative or to try something beyond their capacity where they might fail. You know, it really becomes a strict prison that limits their growth and discovery and finding their purpose. And then behaviorally, they focus on behaviors and punishments and don't think about behaviors as communication for what skills need to be developed. I mean, this is a funny story. I work in a school part time, and we had a kid who got in trouble for using inappropriate language in one of the classes, and so, you know, the automatic response is typically like, okay, that's inappropriate behavior, here's your consequence. But if we really become curious about behavior, and I think one of the most important things we can bring to kids is a sense of curiosity ourselves, and to say, okay, why would this kid, he knows it's not okay to talk like that at school, why would he do that? And when we became curious, it was really clear that this was a kid who had a hard time joining with his peers. He was not socially successful. But when he used that inappropriate language, his peers laughed. They thought he was really funny. He was successful. And I thought, what a brilliant little adaptation that kid made. Like, he was successful. And so for me, the behavior, instead of seeing it, this is a behavioral problem that has to be extinguished, I say, oh, this kid told us something, and this is an opportunity, because he basically told us, I don't have skills in this area. I need some strategies. Somebody teach me. And so I think if schools can start moving to rethink behavior and focus on relationships and the internal life, that can make a huge difference in how we're building children's brains.
Well, I think that's so important and so relevant, particularly now, because you talk about the key being connection. Yet, yes, that is important, but our whole world is alien to that. You know, you see people walking around on their smartphones, and there's no connection.
I know.
There's no connection. I know I was sitting in, what was it, Starbucks, and I saw two folks. Obviously, they were together. They sat down. They looked at the menu, and each one pulled out their own phone and started communicating back and forth on the phone. Not to each other, I don't think, but there was no interaction. So, you know, we're in a world that does not reinforce connection. We're in a world that does not value connection. So it's almost alien.
It is. And that's why your show and the books that we're writing and these conversations are so important. And who would have thought we would be at a time in history where we'd have to defend the importance of connection and relationships? And I think that's part of, you know, the kind of crazy furor for our children to be successful and be enriched and all that means that we're filling their afternoons and their every waking hour with extra tutoring and extra classes. And again, there's nothing necessarily wrong. Like, my kids all play sports and they play music and they love them and they're an important part of their lives. But we know that kids have 10 hours less a week of just free, unstructured playtime, where they were connecting, where they had to problem solve. If one of the kids was kind of being a bully, they had to figure out how to kind of cut
exactly.
that off the path before it escalated. And we're missing all of that. And, you know, I was having dinner with my boys. It was kind of one of those nights between things on a busy day, and we popped into Chick-fil-A for a quick dinner. And we really value eating dinner together, even if it has to be quick like that. But there was a family sitting behind me, and, you know, their children were like 3 and 5. There was a mom and another woman. I don't know if it was a sister or a partner. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. And 2 young children. And both adults were on their phone the entire time and didn't speak a word to the children. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is children have a biological need for attention. And so then they have to start acting up to get the attention,
and then
they get in trouble. So it's this really, tricky cycle.
It's a vicious cycle.
It is.
It certainly is.
When I'm out speaking in the world, people ask me all the time about the impact of screen time on children and their brains. And I can talk about that, but I think what is more important, what I'm really focusing on, is I'm more concerned about screen time for the adults. Because what it does is it really keeps us from attuning to our kids and attuning to ourselves. It's like the minute we have any kind of uncomfortable feeling or anything going on, we can just numb ourselves with, pseudo-connection.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you think that in this world today, that kids are growing too fast? I mean, it's a competitive, technologically advanced world. And are our kids just missing out? Because we talk about play and play is eliminated and we don't see recess like we used to. What do you think? What's your take on that?
Well, you know, it's really interesting that what the studies are showing is that academics, we're actually making kids sit still longer, and we're starting academics earlier and earlier. And so in that way, we are developmentally thrusting things upon them that they are not yet ready for.
Yeah.
And I think, when you look at, it's funny, I talk to parents a lot. I say, okay, tell me what you value. And they'll say, you know, I really value my child, you know, being connected, and I really want them to not feel like school's everything, and I just want them to have a really well-balanced life. And then I say, okay, what would your child say about what's important to you? And then they kind of pause. And then I ask this question, and this is a big convictor, which is not my purpose, but I really want them to be thoughtful about this, and it's something I have to be thoughtful about, too. And I say, okay, what does your child's calendar look like? What do you spend money on, and what do you fight most with your child about? And when you ask those questions, they start realizing that what they're focusing on and what they're giving attention to is not typically what they think they value, right? They're communicating a totally different value set. And when you ask kids, a lot of kids will say, my parents care more about my grades and my homework than they care about me. And so in some ways, we're forcing kids to have responsibilities to be like adults and to perform in these kind of surface-level achievement ways too early. But the science is also showing that kids are growing up slower than they ever have, that kids that are adolescents are less and less likely to get driver's license at age 15.
Yes. Yep.
They're more likely to postpone sexual activity. They're more likely to postpone drinking and drug experimentation. And that it's really kind of stretching adolescence out into a longer period. And the sort of evolutionary psychology behind that, in a nutshell, is that when life is dangerous, you have to grow up fast. You better make money and reproduce and get on with it. But when life is safe, and in a way, like we talked about before, when parents bubble wrap and everything's, protecting them so much, when life is safe, they can take longer to explore and kind of become adults. And when we say, well, you're going to have hardcore high school, then you're going to do hardcore college, then of course you're going to do graduate school, and then you have to go straight into a job, they think, okay, well, it's just a hurried, rush to the finish line. It's going to be a while before I have to really be responsible, but I better be super responsible all along the way, too. So it's kind of this weird mix.
Right, it is. And as we talk about connection, in connection is communication. You know, for generations, communication has been a concern. You know, you go back and my parents don't listen to me, my parents don't understand. Why is communication such an ongoing issue?
Well, for adolescents, they are biologically programmed to do things differently than how their parents have done things. They're programmed biologically to seek out novelty and to be socially engaged, but not so much with their parents, you know, with their peers more likely. I think one of the things that gets in the way of communication and connection is for sure what I've talked about focusing on the achievement and the service behaviors without paying attention to that inner landscape. But I think, and of course we're less connected because we're on our devices. But I think that we have become a society where we're so entrenched in individuality that we've sort of lost the old way where we relied on each other.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with Dr. Tina Payne Bryson. She is the co-author of The Yes Brain, How to Cultivate Courage, Curiosity, Resilience in Your Child. Dr. Bryson, continue.
Well, you know, back when we didn't have the comforts and safety of our modern lives, we had to be in tribes or in groups in order to survive. You know, if you were alone, you were much more likely to be eaten by something, right?
Right.
So we had to really depend on each other to stay in these groups in order to survive. I mean, that was basic survival, to be interconnected and interdependent. And we live such lives as sort of little silos, and even we've seen a huge shift in even extended family being less involved in the rearing of children. And we've sort of lost our way a little bit in focusing on how interconnected we are, that even though the modern conveniences don't make it so that it's dangerous to be on our own, we are still programmed biologically as mammals to be interconnected. And so, you know, what we give attention to fires neurons in our brain. You know, what we focus attention on is actually changing what brain structures are getting activated and what fires wires. So I feel tremendous hope, even though we have lost our way. I think the more that we focus on connection and relationship as really the fundamental need and answer to a lot of our current problems, that we can continue to change our own brains and to change the brains of kids to focus on this interdependence and how we live our daily lives.
Okay. We're in our last segment of the program, and we've got to talk more about this yes brain. I know in your book you identified four fundamentals of the yes brain. Would you share them at this point and elaborate on them? Thank you.
Yes, I'm happy to. So the first fundamental is balance. And balance is about emotional stability or the ability to kind of regulate your brain and body. And really, this is sort of like staying in the green zone, right? That mm-hmm. that I'm going to try and stay in my green zone. And one of the best ways that we can do that, we can help support this kind of emotional balance in our kids, is to help them get enough sleep. Our kids and teenagers are intensely sleep deprived. You know, 13 to 18-year-olds need 8 to 10 hours of sleep a night. And we can't have big, hearty, fat green zones if we're not getting enough sleep. So in terms of balance and promoting balance so that kids can have a yes brain, we want to get them sleep. We want to think about kind of the balance of their life and their structure of their days and what that's like. And we want to emphasize relationship and connection, because when they go outside of the green zone, that's when they need us most. And that's where we can show up for them and say, I can see you're really having a hard time. I'm right here with you. Mm-hmm. So that's balance. And, you know, this can be, I mean, that, let me just pause for one more second on that.
Sure.
What I just said, that idea, let me say it one more time again, because I think it's so revolutionary, that when our children are at their worst, that's when they need us the most. That is what our biology is. And so when your kid is being, you know, it's funny, like my kid, if my kid's like, I hate you, you know, my first instinct is to say, don't talk to me like that. You can't talk to me like that. But they can. They just did. And instead, a no-brain response would be, a no-brain parenting response would be to amplify that and
right.
yell back.
Right.
A yes-brain response would be to say right. calm myself, stay in my green zone, and say, I can see that you're really upset with
mm-hmm.
me. I will listen. What's going on? And then once they're back into the green zone, because that connection and that empathy balances them, it moves them back into the green, and that's where we can effectively teach lessons. And I can say, when you speak to me that way, it's very hurtful. And then we can, you know, we can mm-hmm. do the boundary setting and all that. But when our kids are the most unbalanced, that's when they most need connection, and we can kind of co-regulate with them because their frontal lobe isn't working very well.
Okay.
The second fundamental is resilience, and that's really about expanding their green zone so that they have a really hardy green zone, so that it doesn't take a whole lot to send them out into these reactive states. They stay receptive most of the time. It's not about not feeling feelings. It's about learning how to handle the feelings. You know, it's not about avoiding storms. It's about how to ride out a storm. And this resilience develops as our frontal lobe develops, and as we use opportunities as parents to build skills. So instead of saying, stop yelling at your brother, that would be a no parenting mm-hmm. response. A yes parenting response, which, by the way, is not about telling kids yes to whatever they want.
Okay.
That's not at all what I'm talking about. A yes brain is not about giving in
Good.
To kids or just telling them yes.
Yeah, because sometimes, yes. excuse me for interrupting, but sometimes I think, you know, when you say yes brain and people think, you're talking about the permissive parent, that parent that says, okay, yes, 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 you can do whatever. And I'm glad to hear you. You know,
yes, no, it's not. In fact, we address that in the book. We say, well, this is not what we're saying, because we are huge fans of firm boundaries and high expectations for kids and holding them accountable for what they're doing. Kids don't feel safe if we just tell them yes to whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
So what this is about is, you know, we want them to become self-disciplined human beings, but they can only learn the skills to do that if they're in this yes brain frame of mind or this yes brain neurological state. So what we do is we enforce boundaries, but we do it with empathy and connection. So when my kid refuses to get out of the bathtub and he's being oppositional, I can say, I can see you're really angry right now. It's still time to get out of the bathtub, and I'm going to help you get out. And if you need to cry and be upset about it, that's okay. I'm right here with you as I pull him out of the tub,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's not about being permissive and saying, yes, you can stay in the bathtub. It's about helping him tolerate big feelings, return to balance, so that then we can have the discipline moment where we can really teach and talk about how to handle himself better next time.
Okay.
So the second point is this resilience, which is really about helping kids learn and tolerate having difficult experiences, letting them experience some adversity, and helping them expand their green zone so they have a wide window of tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways we can do that is to teach them that their own minds are powerful, that they don't have to be victim to their circumstances or their emotions, that they have a powerful mind that where they can take a deep breath and calm their bodies down, or they can think about what they could do differently. So it's all really about skill building.
Okay.
So balance, resilience, and the four fundamentals are easy to remember because it's like the cheese, Brie, B-R-I-E. Mm-hmm. So balance and resilience are the B-R. The I is for insight. And this is really the superpower of self-understanding. This is the ability to look inside of ourselves, to give attention to our inner world, and to make choices. So it really creates kind of neurologically, insight allows us to kind of stop an automatic response and to kind of pause and consider options and really have what we call response flexibility. And this is really a way to understand ourselves so that we can be act in the world instead of being reactive in the world. Just self-understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from lots of conversations and lots of reflective dialogue with our kids. Like my kids, you know, my kid hits his brother, and after I calm him down, I say, "What was that about for you? What really made you so upset? And how did you feel that in your body? And what can you do differently next mm-hmm. time?" And then that leads us then to the next thing I would say is, how can you make it right? And that last fundamental is empathy. And empathy, obviously, is understanding how others feel and kind of seeing their minds. But it's also about caring for others and taking actions to care and teaching our kids to act on others' behalf. And when we do something, you know, it's one thing to feel with another, but then if we do something to help someone, that can create such joy within us that it actually kind of makes the brain want to continue to help others. So we can wire empathy in our kids' brains, and one of the most important ways that we can help our children build empathy is to model it and to think about how we offer compassion and empathy for them when they're having a hard time, you know, how we respond to them when they're really struggling. And so those are the four big things, is balance, resilience, insight, and empathy.
How does a parent know when their kid may need, a gentle push out of their comfort zone versus, you know, needing a cushion, okay?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a good question.
Okay.
It is. I struggle with that all the time. Like, my kid says, "I don't want to do that," or "I don't want to mm-hmm. go," or, you know, do I make them go? Do I push them to say, "I know you're uncomfortable with this, and I know you're not very good at it, but we're going to try it anyway," versus saying, "You know what, that is so stressful for you. Let's kind of take that demand away." The way we kind of talk about pushing and cushion is that we do want to push kids beyond what they're comfortable with. You know, I think in this country we have an adversity gap. We have kids who have way too much adversity, and we need to lessen it. We need to provide them with more cushion and more safety. But then we have kids who don't have enough adversity, and they need more of it. That's one of the reasons I'm a big fan of sleepaway camp experiences, is it kind of hits that sweet spot for both sets of kids. But pushing and cushion, kind of, I think one of the best ways to think about that is if we push our kids and we think it's going to send them into the red zone or the blue zone where it's toxic stress, that's too much for them. They don't yet have the capacity to do it, and we might need to do some cushion and some skill building to get them ready for that. They may not be ready. But if we push them and they can stay in the green zone and come out of it and go, "You know what, that was really hard. I didn't like that. I wasn't even very good at it, but it was fine. It was okay." Or, "It was even a little fun." What that does is it expands their capacity, and they see that they can do more and be more. So we do want to push them, but not if it's going to be, if their experience is going to be like, "That was so terrible, I'm never going to, not only am I not going to do that again, I'm not going to try anything new." So sometimes it's a guess on our part, but we just sort of have to see, is this going to move my kid into a threat kind of experience in their body that's too toxic, mm-hmm. or can they tolerate it with a lot of support?
Well, you know, time is flying. We have a few minutes left, and I can think of a number of things I want to ask you. But let's look at failure for a minute. What role does failure play in this whole process?
When we focus as a culture, in a school, as a society in general, in our homes, on a narrow view of success, and we talk about success as achievement, then children become paralyzed by a fear of failure.
Uh-huh.
If what we value is getting the achievement, then there's no room for them to explore or make mistakes or even just sort of be curious, because they just have to get the marks, you know? And so I think what we see is a lot of kids who end up in therapy are kids who are flooded with anxiety and perfectionism and an inner critical voice that's saying, you're so stupid, you should have done better, you know, and they're so hard on themselves. And I think part of that is because we have created, you know, of course we would say, of course kids make mistakes, everybody makes mistakes, and you should try new things. But the message they're getting more often is, the stakes are too high, you better not make a mistake, you better be the best at the best of everything. And so we really have to think about what we're valuing and what we're giving attention to, because what we give attention to and what we emphasize is really what they go off. And it actually wires their brain, and it becomes who they become.
How do we cultivate open-mindedness and curiosity in children? I mean, you have some strategies that you may share.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most important ones, and we every section of the book has a section about our own yes brains, and I think the most important thing in terms of if we want to help kids have a balanced, resilient, insightful, empathetic brain that allows them to be, you know, open and curious and resilient in the world, we have to foster that within ourselves. We need to nurture our own green zones, making sure we're getting enough sleep and that we have, you know, time with friends and times to get away from stress and some self-care that allows us to have a good, hearty green zone. And then the other thing we know is that what helps create an open, creative child that is successful, that has an inner compass, is a child who grows up with at least one adult who emphasizes the connection that you and I have been talking so much about. Mm-hmm. And so one of the most important things we can think about is that when children are having a hard time, these are opportunities to help them have their whole brain wire up in the most optimal way by being present to them. And I think, you know, if we can say to kids, I can see you're having a hard time, I'm right here with you. And the research shows that when kids feel safe, seen, so safe is like someone's got my back, seen is I understand how you feel, soothed is I'm right here with you, or I'm here if you need me, and then secure, where they know that when they have a need, someone's going to see and respond to it most of the time, that their brains become so built for this curious, open response. And that's based on attachment research. And the research really shows that one of the most important predictors for how well a kid turns out is that they have that secure attachment with at least one person. That does not mean the parent has to be perfect.
Right.
It means that the parent has to show up when the kid needs them. So I think one of the most important things we can do to foster this approach in the world is to keep our own green zones in mind, and that when our kids go outside of the green zone, use connection and empathy to bring them back in, and that will not only help in the moment, but it will expand their green zones and allow them to be resilient and successful in the world.
In these last 2 minutes, can you comment on, I know every parent listening wants to hear about this, discipline.
Discipline is
a challenging area. Do you have any suggestions that you can offer about discipline? And I know it varies according to age, but, you know, just...
Yeah. I do, and I love to talk about that. And, you know, Dan and I have a whole book called No Drama Discipline about, you know, that whole idea. I love talking about this because what I'm about to say is so counterculture, but it's based in the science. The most important thing about discipline is for kids to become self-disciplined. That requires that we teach them and build skills they cannot learn if they are not in the green zone. So in the name of discipline, we might need to comfort and soothe to get them back in that place, and that's where we teach the lesson. We have to think about bad behaviors as our children communicating to us the areas they still need skill building in. Our job isn't to punish or to just get rid of a behavior. Our job is to say, my child needs some skill building in this area. So focus on teaching. That's what discipline is about teaching and building skills.
And just briefly, would you comment, we've got about 30 seconds, on parenting and how the parents can keep themselves in a positive light real quickly?
Well, we have to be gentle with ourselves. We're hard on ourselves sometimes as parents. So I would say be gentle with yourself. Take care of yourself. You matter too. Your health and sanity and happiness sets the tone for the rest of your family. So you matter too. And so do things that bring you joy and bring you rest, and allow you to be a safe haven for the rest of your family.
Well, I thank you. I have been talking with Dr. Tina Bryson. She is the co-author of Yes Brain, How to Cultivate Courage, Curiosity, and Resilience in Your Child. To my listening audience, I want to say thank you for your ear and your time. Appreciate you listening. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.